for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. In today's world of digitalization, ebooks, and internet databases, libraries might seem like dinosaurs. But the director of the Harvard University Library says the past bodes well for their future. Robert Darnton has a unique perspective on books and the written word. He's been a reporter for the New York Times, an editorial advisor, and a digital publishing entrepreneur. He's a recognized expert on 18th century France and the history of books. He joins me in the studio to talk about how printed and digital modes of communication can coexist. He's just published a new book. It's a collection of essays titled The Case for Books, Past, Present, and Future. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing from you. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. You can also reach us through Facebook and Twitter. Good morning to you, sir. It's good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
I know that your study of book history has gone on for a long period of time. Tell me about that and how you got started in it.
Well, you know, I followed up a footnote, and I didn't know at the time I was doing book history. The word hardly existed. In fact, it begins in French, Histoire du livre, and it sounds a little awkward in English, history of the book or history of books, book history. In fact, I saw a footnote when I was a graduate student at Oxford, and the footnote suggested that maybe there were some unpublished letters by one of these French characters who was in love with America. This is in the 1770s and 80s. He was trying to get in touch with Thomas Jefferson, and I was following Jefferson myself. So I wrote to the municipal library of Neuchâtel, Switzerland, a tiny little library in Switzerland near the French border, to say, do you have any letters by this character? His name is Jacques-Pierre Brissot. They said, oh, yes, we have 119 letters.
My goodness.
Well, you bet.
What a treasure trove.
And, you know, this man is one of the, say, 10 most important leaders of the French Revolution. He's big stuff, not so well known in this country, but in France, he's the last of the moderates before Robespierre. So I thought I'd better get to Neuchâtel, which I did. There were the 119 letters surrounded by 50,000 letters of people who had to do with books, printers, booksellers, publishers, authors, smugglers. It was paradise for a historian, a young historian. I started to write a biography of my man, Brissot, and then I dropped it because I thought the more important subject is books. How did books penetrate into society? Mm. What books did people read in a country that was about to explode in the first great revolution of modern times? So I have been going back to this lovely little Swiss city for, at last count, 14 summers, one winter, and also using archives in Paris elsewhere. And I've fallen in love with the subject of book history, which since then actually has blossomed everywhere.
Well, and of course, the case for books goes back to the case for the written word far earlier. When does all that begin?
Ah, well, if we were to begin at the beginning, we would have to go back to roughly 4000 BC. I mean, that's when writing of some sort was, we think, developed. About 1000 BC, you get alphabetical writing, which is a huge leap forward. And then there are a series of what I would call technological breakthroughs. One, which may sound awfully simple, is the codex. That's a book that you read by turning the pages instead of unrolling a scroll. Hmm. That was developed sometime around the birth of Christ, and it's still going strong. We still read books that are printed codexes. The next great technological breakthrough, of course, is Gutenberg. So we're now in the 1440s, 1450s. And I would say that after that, it's today, or yesterday, if you like. I mean, the last 20 years have been a time of astonishing technological change, which is transforming the world.
What about the pages on which those early words were written once the codex came into being?
Well, you know, the page as a unit of perception is very interesting. It's quite different from what you see on a screen or on a handheld device, and I think it's a way of organizing information that works very well. We've got now a lot of information about how pages developed. For example, for most of the history of books, there was not a separation of sentences, very little punctuation, no paragraphs. It took a long time for the book as we know it to evolve. And certainly the Romans, when they read and gave speeches, were reading from wax tablets in which there was no – the words ran together. So the unit was one of sound for orators. It's fascinating. And in fact, we do believe that most books were read aloud and in groups until fairly recently when they're read silently by individuals.
You have actually held in your hand, I gather, pages that were written on rags or pieces of very, very flimsy fabric.
That's correct, because all paper, and well, almost all paper, until roughly 1820, 1830 in the West, was made from pulped rags. And each sheet of paper was made individually by hand by a very skilled artisan. It involved an elaborate technique. But the point is, there were rag pickers, and they picked good rags, medium rags, bad rags. The rags were sorted, they were rotted, they were pulped, and they were mixed with water to make a kind of soup. The paper maker dipped something that looked rather like a screen, a window screen, into the soup, jiggled it, and flipped it onto some felt, and when it dried, it became a sheet of paper. That means that when you look at an old book, you can see the lines of the screen and the filigrane, or we call it filigrane in French, the watermark. And sometimes I see bits of rags, you know, somebody's skirt that somehow didn't get ground up, and that you can actually pick it out of the paper. So whenever I read a book printed before roughly 1810, 1820, I hold the paper up to the light and try to see what went in. It's very moving to do that, I find.
Robert Darnton, he's director of the Harvard University Library. He's founder of the Gutenberg E program. He's former professor of European history at Princeton University, the author of more than a dozen books. His latest, a series of essays, it's titled The Case for Books, Past, Present, and Future. Do join us, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. I'm really fascinated with these letters you found that really supplemented the archives of what was happening in the Bastille during the French Revolution. Tell us about those.
Well, working in the archives of the Bastille is endlessly fascinating. There's a special library in Paris, the Bibliothèque de l'Arsenal, where these papers are located. Sometimes you see actually the imprint of a heel of a shoe on them, because when the Bastille was stormed and taken apart, they threw the letters into the street. It was a moment of exultation. And then they realized, wait a minute, these are important.
And they began gathering. And they went about collecting them.
That's right.
Wow.
In fact, the Russian ambassador collected a lot of them and sent them off to Catherine the Great in Russia, so that I've gone to St. Petersburg to read some of them. But most of them are in Paris. And It's hard to describe the sensation of reading these materials, but you open a box, and in the box are a series of folders. You open the folders, and there are often interrogations. So you see the prisoner being interrogated in the Bastille, question, answer. At the bottom of each page, the prisoner initials his or her name.
So a secretary is taking these words down verbatim as much as possible by hand.
Well, of course, it's all by hand. There were no typewriters, so we're talking pens and quills and old-fashioned paper. It's not really verbatim. They usually take the form, said that, and then you get a summary of what the prisoner said. But you can see the police laying traps for the prisoner and the prisoner trying to step around the trap in order to avoid incriminating some colleague or getting into deeper trouble herself. And I say herself because many of them were women. And I've even found one who was a domestic servant in Versailles. So the papers of the Bastille give you a view of people who wrote books, peddled books, sold books, through all layers of society.
And do they refer to conditions within the Bastille?
They do, but you know, some revisionist historians treat the Bastille as though it were a three-star hotel. It wasn't. Prisoners were not tortured. The food was decent. If you had money, you could buy better food. It was not a torture house at all, but the psychological condition of people who were cut off from everyone was terrible. I think that was the worst part.
Robert Darnton, director of the Harvard University Library. His new book is titled The Case for Books, Past, Present, and Future. And, of course, we're talking about not only the past, but the present and future in Robert Darnton's new book, The Case for Books. Here's an email from Stephanie, who said, there is hope for books with the younger generation. On a trip with my 11-year-old daughter, we noticed a man using a Kindle. She loves her iPod, and I asked her what she thought about the ability to have electronic books. She was appalled. She said, you can't play with the corner of the page as you get ready to turn it, and you would miss out on the new book smell when you first crack it open.
That's wonderful. You know, people love the smell of books. That may sound surprising, but it really is true. And I would add, the older the book, the better the smell. There is a French publisher of electronic books, so books you can only get on your computer, who did a study of what the French readers liked about books, and they said, the smell. So he invented a kind of sticker that you put on your computer and you scratch it to get a nice
marvelous
old book smell.
And here from Facebook, Andrea says, I love the instant gratification factor of my Kindle. If I hear about a book on NPR, I can be reading it in seconds. whereas a non-electric book would not be readily available until I get to the library or a store.
Well, I sympathize with that. I'm all for technological progress. I'm big on e-books. I'm even writing an electronic book myself. But speed isn't everything, in my opinion. There's a lot to be said for reading slowly, for getting the feel of the page, for generally orienting yourself in the entire text, cover to cover. So, all right, if some people want to dash through a book, that's fine for them. But for me, I'd rather read slowly.
And Annette, who sends us another message through Facebook, I think agrees with you. She says, there's nothing like the relationship I have with a book. If it's a good one, it gets all the caressing, casting away, and mauling it can handle. To look at my beloved books is to bring back the memory of the intimate experience. That is something that cannot be digitally duplicated.
I agree. It can't. And it's wonderful to contemplate books you've read on a shelf. They're like old friends. And sometimes you take them out and you might see a mark you made 20, 30 years ago, and it recalls the person you once were and the experience you once had.
Do you collect old books?
Well, I admit I do. I'm not a fancy collector. What I collect, actually, are what the French used to call bad books, that is, prohibited books. Now, most of the Enlightenment was prohibited. It took because of the censorship and the police force of the Booksellers Guild in Paris. It's all published outside of France, smuggled into France, and spread everywhere. Well, I collect a lot of these books, not by famous writers, by often obscure writers, but I think I've found a way to figure out retrospectively what the best sellers were. So I have my own little collection of forgotten bestsellers from the 18th century.
So where does that take you when you read in the newspaper that a book like Huckleberry Finn is being banned in one library in one state, or some other children's book taken off the library shelves?
Well, I think it's shocking, of course, and Huckleberry Finn was banned in Massachusetts for a while. The struggle for the liberty of the press is a struggle that goes on and on. It's not as if it was resolved with the First Amendment to the Constitution. And it's in itself a fascinating subject. This does not appear in my book that I've just published, but I've done a study of censorship in East Germany and actually got to know some of the censors and talked with them. They thought that what they were doing was a good thing, and that censorship was required for socialism, what they called social engineering. So the history of censorship itself is a fascinating subject.
Do you think, considering, you know, the mix of reactions that people have to both books and their Kindle, or and that, like Kleenex, I think is going to become sort of a generic word, isn't it? Do you think that e-books and the internet databases are going to somehow replace books as we know them?
Well, I wouldn't say replace, Diane. It seems to me, in fact, that they can complement books. So what I see is a transitional period now that we're living in, when the analog and the digital will coexist, and then a phase when maybe 10 years from now, who knows, when the digital communication will predominate. But it seems to me that the old-fashioned codex is such a great machine, a machine for reading, that it will never die, and that we will read books in printed form and at the same time have them on our computers so that we can call up all kinds of links, data, images, sounds. In fact, I'm publishing next year a book about street songs in Paris, which will be published in print, but also online, and the reader can listen to the songs sung the way they were sung in the 18th century.
But think of how sad it would have been if all of those messages, all of those notes and letters that you found from the Bastille had been done on email, they would have been gone.
That's right. It's speaking now as a director of a great university library, I'm appalled at the amount of material we are losing. There was a famous case of the 1960 census. I don't know if you've heard of that, but it was believed that it was completely lost because of antiquated hardware and software. Now, thanks to some brilliant computer engineering in 1976, it was recovered. But the danger of losing communication by email, information on websites, is tremendous. I believe that in the Bush administration from 2001 to 2005, all of the White House email is missing. I mean, think of what historians in the future are going to do.
But if those computer specialists in 1975 could somehow restore that census data of 1960, couldn't someone, perhaps in 2020, finally get hands on White House data that was lost?
Well, I hope so, but I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Because the problem is not just the so-called erosion of the zeros and ones of digitalized texts, but also what we call metadata, that is how you locate something in cyberspace. It could be perfectly preserved out there somewhere, but if you can't find it using catalog-type descriptions, you're in serious trouble.
You know, this whole debate over e-books versus books, printed data versus e-data, strikes me in comparison to the onset of television and what the predictions were about radio. And people pronounced it the death of radio. And of course, what has happened is that radio has continued to climb in listenership and television viewing, at least on network sites, has gone down.
That's right. I couldn't agree more. And in fact, that illustrates what I think is a general proposition in the history of communication, namely that one medium does not displace another. We've only recently discovered that manuscript publishing flourished for three centuries after Gutenberg. So it wasn't as if the invention of printing with movable characters simply wiped out manuscript publishing. Quite the opposite happened. And you could apply that to many things: the flourishing of radio after the onset of television, and the continuation of television after computers.
With all of your interest in the historical background of books and the written word, and your interest in writing books yourself, doing an e-book, what do you do as director of the Harvard Library to balance all of these different interests of yours?
Well, I don't sleep a lot. I don't take vacations. Probably I should. But I'm enjoying it. I mean, it's the most exhilarating job imaginable, not simply because this is a great research library, but because this library is part of the creation of the new information landscape. If we can get it right at Harvard, I think we will have some influence in the way that information in general will be exchanged.
What do you mean, get it right?
Well, getting it right means, for one thing, protecting the interest of the public. It's true that Harvard is a private university. Some people say it's just for an elite and you can turn in on yourselves and enjoy your great library. We don't think that way at all. It seems to me that the Harvard University Library has a responsibility not just to the faculty and students, but to the whole nation and, in fact, the whole world of learning. So I want to open up the library through digitization, through open access, in order to make it possible for people everywhere to have to read these books, even if they can't read them in paper.
But even as Harvard tries to do that, move forward in that way, libraries around the country are closing down because of lack of funds, lack of facilities. What do you make of that?
Well, I think it's a tragedy every time a library closes. I'm on the board of trustees of the New York Public Library, which has terrible financial difficulties because a lot of its funds come from the city and the state. We are struggling to survive. Now, at Harvard, the university library won't go under. But, you know, more books are published every year than in the preceding year, with the exception of the year 2008-09 when the financial crisis hit the publishing industry. But soon a million books will be published worldwide every year in print. So the printed book, there are more and more copies of printed books, and we at the Harvard Library must keep up our normal acquisitions while at the same time advancing on the digital front. Now, how to do this simultaneously is something that wakes me up in the middle of the night, because if we don't keep an adequate record, who will?
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. My guest is Robert Darnton. He is the director of the Harvard Library, Harvard University Library. He's also the founder of the Gutenberg E-Program. Tell us about that.
Well, the Gutenberg E-Program is an attempt to create a new kind of book, in fact, an electronic book that will make the most of the possibilities of digital publishing, so it can include images, sound, film, all sorts of evidence that would not be possible in the case of a traditional printed book. But the idea was to take prize dissertations, the very best of PhDs, and to convert them into electronic books that would serve as a model for scholarship in this new form, and we hope legitimize it. Because, you know, a lot of chairs of history departments are very skeptical. Is this a real book, they would say. Well, we think not only are they real books, but they're superb books.
All right, let's open the phone first to Ann Arbor, Michigan. Good morning, Sarah. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Diane. So nice to talk to you. Thank you for taking my call.
Of course.
I am a professional author and have been for 20 years. I am also the project manager for the Internet's only online professional author cooperative. We are big boosters of the ebook revolution because it's allowing us to get our out-of-print work back into print and out to our readers. But I would like to hear your guest speak a little to the challenges that this revolution in books, in distribution, and in printing present to the individual working author?
Well, I'll do my best. It's a very difficult question because, of course, we constantly come back to this issue of sustainability. It costs money to produce an e-book as well as a printed book, even though there are savings in warehousing, transport, and that kind of thing. And it seems to me that editors add a lot of value. They do selecting, they do editing, they improve the quality of things, and so on. And I'm worried that the role of editors is threatened as well. So I'm all for authors' cooperatives. I think that's great, and I'm a great partisan of open access. But I do worry about how we're going to pay for it. And I hope that you are working your way toward a solution.
Thanks for calling, Sarah. And now to Hebron, Illinois. Good morning, Phil.
Good morning, Ms. Rehm. It's a wonderful show today.
Thank you.
I guess I have, it's more of a statement than a question, but I would like your professor's reaction to it. Recently, I went to a book reading by an author. I read a tremendous amount of nonfiction, a lot of it under your great recommendations. And I was sitting in the office, in the audience, reading the book Googled. And in that book, engineers at Google, who I would say are considered the powerhouse in electronic books, at least in scanning out-of-print works, stated that feel reading an e-book on a Kindle or something, that term is completely different than reading a hard-printed copy. It's a different form of reading. And interestingly enough, at the end of the lecture by the author, I went up and talked to her, and I'm 53 years old, and I said, you had kind of an old crowd. She said, actually, you're a young man. My audience is usually on oxygen. I just wondered what you thought of that.
Well, I respect audiences of any age. It's good to have them. But the question really is, how feasible and how different are these electronic books, the kind of books that you might read on a handheld device? It seems to me fair to say that the nature of reading itself is different. When you are looking at a small segment of text and not turning a page, you are taking in a different unit of communication, so that we find among our students that often their attention span isn't what it ought to be.
It's shorter.
It's shorter. Mm-hmm. And what is lost is also context. And even reflection. I was saying that I'm in favor of slow reading. I think that we should teach our students to read more critically and more slowly.
Robert Darnton, his new book is titled The Case for Books, Past, Present, and Future. He's also director at the Harvard University Library. More of your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
National broadcast of the Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy, presenting Germany Info, a web publication with daily news from Germany, business and investment information, and suggestions for travel to Europe, on the web at germany.info. From the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, your source for what works in public education. Learn more at edutopia.org. And by the Ford Foundation, working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide at fordfoundation.org. This is NPR.
Fantastic Mr. Fox is Wes Anderson's first film using stop-motion animation. He says it's the most involved filmmaking he's ever done.
Every little prop and every little moment is going to have a lot of thought go into it, and it's an opportunity. But it's not going to take care of itself. Nothing's going to just be discovered like stumbling across a location.
Wes Anderson on the next Fresh Air.
Welcome back. And if you've just joined us, the director of the Harvard University Library, Robert Darnton, is with me. He has been the author of many books. His latest is a series of essays. It's titled The Case for Books, Past, Present, and Future. Let's go back to the phones, this time to Indianapolis. Good morning, Joan. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, Diane. It's so good to be on your show.
Thank
You're
you.
You're just wonderful.
Oh, thanks.
I work in a bookstore, and I have for many, many years, and we are, of course, concerned about what this is going to do to bookstores in the future, and also if he could address the huge difference between children's books and the size and the feel and the colors in those, and how they would transfer those to the electronic readers. And I will take any comment off the air.
Thank you.
Well, I have a lot of sympathy for bookstores, especially independent bookstores. It seems to me that they are the salt of the earth. And so I congratulate you, Joan, for working for such a good cause. I do agree that bookstores could be threatened, but there is hope. I believe that some of these new readers, such as you may have heard of the espresso book machine, which can print a book in less than 4 minutes and sell it often at a very cheap price will bring new life back to bookstores. So it could be that the technology will work in your favor. As to children's books, myself, I love children's books. I have 3 children. I taught all 3 of them to read. We spent a great deal of time with books in our house. We even have a small collection of children's books. And I absolutely take the point you're making that they have a special feel, a special size. The illustrations are important. They're so imaginative and innovative when compared with a normal adult's book. How can those qualities be captured online? Well, frankly, I don't think they can.
Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak. How could you do that?
I don't know. Maybe someone will think of a way. Yeah. But for the time being, I would rather read normal children's books to my grandchildren.
You know, I have recently had the good fortune of traveling to Egypt and Jordan and visiting the Alexandria Library, the brand new
yes.
facility, and they are getting ready to install this equipment that can print out any book in minutes.
Yes. We have one in the Harvard bookstore right now, and I've seen it work. It's fabulous.
So any book that you want.
Well, we have to qualify that, I'm afraid, Diane, because it has to be any book that is available in the particular database of that particular publisher. So a book in the public domain is fine. But now if the book is restricted by copyright, it can only be downloaded and printed out with the agreement of the rights holders.
Tell me about your reaction to, I should preface this by saying you've been the director of the Harvard University Library for the last 2.5 years. After you got there as director, you found out there were secret talks going on between Harvard and Google. Tell me about that and what happened.
Well, it's a complicated story, but to my amazement, on my very first day on the job, I found myself sitting with the university council, who explained to me that indeed Harvard was in secret negotiations with Google. The secrecy was required because of non-disclosure agreements.
Okay, but what was the deal to be?
The deal involved a lawsuit against Google by the Authors Guild and the Association of American Publishers. They were suing Guild for alleged breach of copyright. Why? Well, because Google was digitizing books in great research libraries, beginning with 4, the first being Harvard. And at first, we certainly agreed that Google could digitize books in the public domain. But we did not agree to let our books that were covered by copyright be digitized. However, Google moved into the copyright area, notably in the Great Library of the University of Michigan, and therefore was, in the eyes of the authors and publishers, breaking copyright. Well, they then began to negotiate a settlement. And this took them, I think, more than 3 years.
Who is they? You're saying Google.
Google on the one hand, the authors and the publishers
okay.
on the other.
All right.
However, they couldn't really make the settlement work unless they had the agreement of the libraries because, after all, we had the books, or what they call content. So they had to inform us about it. And hence, I found myself following these negotiations and trying to make sense of the incredible legalese in which it was being written over months and months. The result has now been made public. In October 2008, the settlement was announced. Everyone could study it. And there was, I think, a wave of doubt as to whether the settlement really was in the interest of the public, of ordinary readers and libraries, and not simply the commercial interests of the 2 parties of the lawsuit.
So how far does the revised legal settlement Google filed in federal court this year. How far does it go toward resolving these concerns?
Well, it's fascinating, really, because the settlement was supposed to be filed in the District Court for the Southern District of New York on the 17th of October. But while that date was approaching, so many people filed amicus briefs and memoranda with the court that it began to look to Google as though there was a wave of public opinion turning against the settlement. Now, the people who filed these objections included the Federal Republic of Germany, the French Republic, and the Department of Justice, which warned that the settlement would violate antitrust law. So at the last minute, Google and the plaintiffs asked to postpone the deadline, shifted it to the 9th of November. When that deadline came, they asked to postpone it again until 5 days later, and at last it has now appeared. Well, how much has it changed? That is a question that lawyers all over the country are studying. In my opinion, there have been some good changes, but the basic change, which is rather difficult to explain, but basically gives Google a monopoly over books that are covered by copyright but are not in print, that has not changed. Hmm. And therefore, Google has, in effect, a kind of monopoly over this great, vast collection of digitized books.
Interesting. All right. Let's, on that note, go to Daryl in Birmingham, Alabama. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Ms. Reams. Let me tell you, it's an absolute pleasure to talk to you. I've been listening to you now here at work for about a year, and I always enjoy everyone that you have.
I'm so glad, sir. Go right ahead.
All right, this is for Mr. Darden. First of all, let me say it's a blessing to talk to you. I thought I was the only one that loved books as much as I do. I have a collection of about 500 myself, my oldest being an 1826 Kemper and Sharpless Bible that I absolutely adore. My most immediate question, and you guys just touched on it ever so briefly, with Google, and one of the things I've been doing recently is a lot of the things, especially historical related, that deals with my area, I've been able to find copies that have been digitized on Google, which I find extremely helpful. So my question would be, how do you think Google's digitization process is going to help people that are trying to do research of books or material that are out of print?
Well, Daryl, I think it's simply fabulous. There are things that can be criticized, as I've just done, about the book settlement. But the fact is that Google's digitization is stupendous. It is going to make available to people like you millions and millions of books in digitized form that you wouldn't be able to get near otherwise. So I'm an enthusiast for Google Book Search in principle. In the case of your 1826 Bible, you can compare it with other editions of the Bible in the same year, in preceding years. You can go all the way back, if you like, to the King James Bible. You can see Bibles of all shapes and forms, red-letter Bibles, non-red-letter Bibles. The whole history of the Bible is simply fascinating, the publishing history. You know, we talk about citing chapter and verse. Well, of course, the Bible wasn't always in chapter and verse. It was one stream of words, not even separated by chapters. And in some cases, you couldn't even tell where one book began and another ended. So the way it's presented typographically is extremely significant for the way it's read and what its meaning is. So I hope, Daryl, that you will be able to compare your Bible with those of many other centuries.
And who made those changes along the line?
Well, that's part of the, that's why I think the history of books is so fascinating. We do have a lot of information. And in the case of the King James Bible, we know exactly how it happened. Believe it or not, it was written by committee. It's often said, you know, that nothing good can be written by committee, but here's a great masterpiece of the early 17th century that was produced by three separate commissions, each of which had, as I recollect, about 15 people. They were experts in several languages. They wove the still Shakespearean English together and came up with the most wonderful book imaginable. But it was a book that involved a lot of political compromises.
Oh, I'll bet.
You might not think so. You think, well, the text of the Bible is the text of the Bible. But this was after a century of religious warfare, and the danger was that there would be footnotes and marginal notes that would provide a running commentary on the text that could sound too Calvinistic, too Catholic, too much for someone's taste.
Was there an Old Testament and a New Testament? When did that division take place?
Well, of course, the Old Testament outdates the New Testament. And I should be able to tell you just when the two were combined, but I can't. It's ignorance on my part. I mean, you know, we talk about the official Bible of the Catholic Church, which has been revised in many points, but I don't know exactly when it all came together in something like the form we would recognize.
And of course, the interpretation of each of those passages, the construction of the sentence of each of those passages has had such import on the political life of each country, area, the whole world.
Yes, it has. And think of the number of people who were memorizing sections of the Bible so that that was deep in their conscious and even their subconscious.
And you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Layton, Utah. Good morning, David.
Good morning to you both.
Hi.
Hi, I work at a library in Utah, and we actually just recently we're in the middle of a book sale right now, and the number of book donations is actually far above what we expected. But interestingly enough, I'm also a DJ, so when I receive music through a college radio station, I get it in three formats. I get it in occasionally, I get a vinyl record. About 40% of the time, it's on a CD. And about 50% of the time, 50 to 60%, it's digitally. I believe that books have to go through the conversion that music did to digital for people to realize how much they miss, truly miss, the analog version before they'll go back, because vinyl records are being produced more now than they were 10 years ago.
Well, that's news to me. I didn't know that. And I think it's fascinating because it does illustrate the principle that, as I was saying, one medium does not displace another
one.
Exactly. I think also that the prevalence of digital means of communication has created a kind of awareness, sharpened the consciousness of people about the old-fashioned book. So I find when I teach the history of books at Harvard that the students are just enthralled with the book as an object because, of course, these students were, as we say, digital natives.
And a final call from Darlene in Paducah, Kentucky. Good morning, Darlene. Thanks for being with us. Darlene, I guess you hung up, unfortunately. Let's go to Rick in Virginia Beach. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I'm going to say I'm a lifelong reader and a hardcore reader, but I love my Kindle and the electronic books it provides. My undergraduate work was a double major in literature and in political science with a minor in physics. And I remember having a Tuesday, Thursday book pack and a Monday, Wednesday, Friday sack full of books that I would drag all over that university. And it's so wonderful to have it all. And you put up to 1,500 books on a Kindle.
And traveling on airplanes, you see these all the time.
Yes, that's right. There's no question that the Kindle, the Sony Reader, are very convenient. And if you are going on a long vacation and you want to read a dozen books or so, this could make a lot of sense. So I'm all for convenience, all for digitization, all for progress and technology, the rest of it. But I love the old-fashioned book, and I hope that we will continue to treasure it while we move forward in the more modern technological forms of communication.
So, as one of our callers said, maybe we have to go through this revolution to realize how precious it is to hold a book in your hand. The book I am holding is titled The Case for Books. The author, Robert Darnton, is the director of the Harvard University Library. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Diane.
And thanks for listening, all. Have a great day. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org.